For June 2nd, 2016, it's the Lullabot Podcast.
Lullabot Podcast.
It's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 188. I'm Matt Cleave, developer at Lullabot. With me, I have Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Mike and I are the co-hosts of the Lullabot Podcast. We get together about every other week, and we talk about Drupal, or web development, or the internet, or Mike's dog, or the web. Yeah. So, the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about the DrupalCon fun, the DrupalCon fever, as it were.
The Drupal flu?
Some of us, anyway. Yes, yes. So today we're going to talk a little bit about, the future of Drupal and the open web and the future of the web
in general, which I think might even like play into the future of the human race.
Ooh, I like it. So with us to talk about that, we're going to bring in a special guest. He's the co-founder and head of product at Pantheon. He's been on Drupal.org for over 12 years, user 3313 if you're counting. Yeah, the 3000s, that's cool. He was part of the 2003 Howard Dean presidential campaign. Yeah! Which was an early high-profile use case for Drupal via the Dean Space project, which lived on his civic space and helped seed the early Drupal economy through among nonprofits. He's a founding partner of Chapter 3, and now with Pantheon, it's Josh Koenig. Hey, Josh.
How's it going? Glad to be here.
You're outlandish Josh on the internet in places, right?
That is pretty much where you can find me on the internet. I've got a fever, and the only cure is more Drupal.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So you've been doing some writing recently on the Pantheon blog and elsewhere about Drupal 8 and Drupal's destiny. So just kind of give me the high level about what you're thinking.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote, so this is the Drupal's destiny sort of, I don't know, theme has been something I've been developing and has been evolving and changing quite a bit, you know, for the past several years. It started, Tom McCracken from Level 10 invited me to keynote Dallas Drupal Days, I think 3 years ago. And I think it was the first time I'd ever done a keynote type presentation at a camp. And so I was trying to think of something properly high level to talk about. And so this idea of Drupal's destiny kind of, you know, started pinging around in my head, and it seemed like a good thing to do. And, you know, the original talk was very bare bones. And it's just really kind of looking at what is going on the web at large, and then how does Drupal fit into that, and what does that mean for us, and, you know, what should we be thinking about? And I've kind of continued to refine and expand that talk over the years. And I gave an updated version of the talk at Drupal Camp Atlanta last fall, and that was just right after Drupal 8.0.0 came out. And so it was really kind of like, let's review, and now that Drupal 8 is a real thing, let's review the sort of Drupal's destiny thesis. And it sort of like changed and refined a number of things. And then for DrupalCon New Orleans, sort of expanded that. And I there was like a video of the talk, but I didn't really like write it up very well. And so I wanted to write up, you know, a good blog post about that. And the short answer is that, like, you know, there's a larger, the web is expanding, the web is evolving, the you know, stuff is always moving. And there's this kind of, you know, future fork in the road for all of us that kind of leads us towards ways that are more open or less open. And I think Drupal is, you know, clearly on the side of openness, and that there's a, you know, there's a particularly important role for Drupal to play where openness can be brought to use cases that aren't very simple. Like there are a lot of, you know, Drupal gets used for simple sites all the time, but it's a really it's a powerful tool, and I think everybody acknowledges that, and that's one of the things that makes it great. There aren't very many other tools with comparable power to Drupal in the open space. Like the tools that people typically bring to bear for complicated use cases are either like big enterprise-y proprietary software, or like complete ground up custom software development. And Drupal is like, you know, Drupal makes the open proposition much more palatable where you have these like more like exacting use cases and more complex requirements. And so I think like acknowledging that is actually our ace. That's our best thing to go with, and recognizing that as a community and sort of, you know, getting behind it and being really proud of that, I think is important, because it really does matter.
Talk about the a little, maybe we could go into a little bit of definitions here when you're talking about openness in the open web and Drupal's place there.
Yeah, this is something that you know, Dries has talked about quite a bit, and there's you know, other sort of leaders on the web have talked about, and it's not a very super well-defined concept at the moment. And I'm actually working on another blog post that's a little bit more even higher level. That's like, what do we mean when we say the open web, and how does this all fit in? Like, I think there's a lot of people recognize that there are specific developments right now, like with Facebook Instant Pages and maybe with Google's accelerated mobile pages, which are like directly, but you can see like directly threatening to openness, because they're like, well, more of the content is moving inside the umbrella of these big companies. And I think that's a part of what is the open web movement is a reaction against. But I also think that there's this kind of, whenever I talk with anyone in any depth about what they mean by the open web and what like the values of the open web are, not like what like, it's kind of, oftentimes the discussion now is framed around what the open web isn't. But if we start to talk about, when you start talking about what the open web is, in my experience and like in my heart of hearts, it really gets back to kind of like the original web. It's like, you know, small pieces loosely joined. It's like lots of people able to connect in the way that they see fit. It's open. It's not, I mean, open source is a part of it, but it's also much more about open protocols and open standards and open languages and the ability for people to use this kind of really, really powerful, essentially neutral playing field, right? Like net neutrality is a really big part of protecting the open web too, in my opinion. Like the web is this kind of level playing field where anyone can publish and anyone can link, and anyone, now we're moving towards a more and more integrated web. And like, you know, there's kind of really interesting conversations to be had there. But to me, it's much more about that original vision of a really open and connected space versus the kind of movement towards like proprietary platforms or closed platforms or walled gardens, or even in my opinion, sometimes the new wave of template-based website construction tools they're kind of on the borderline, because on the one hand, it's great that you can get a website put together really quickly if you're like my mom, but on the other hand, you're not really learning the web. You're learning this like piece of custom software. You're kind of, you know, you're not learning the internet. You're learning Squarespace.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. You know, I've done a little bit of reading up on this and prep for the podcast, and like the two words that I see over and over again when we talk about the open web is control and freedom, mm-hmm. you know, and being able to do what you want. So like, how does that play into, you know, with Google AMP, with Facebook Insta Pages, and with other, you know, quote, walled gardens?
Yeah, so I think I'm trying to and hopefully I'll have a beautiful picture for this in the blog post, but I imagine this like a bit of a spectrum, right? And so if you look at on the far end of the less open end of the spectrum is probably Facebook. And I actually want to, actually before we do this, I want to sort of say out front that I don't think that everything has to be open. I actually think that a generally open web is one that should tolerate elements of it that are closed and or they're closed for good reason. They're just private communities and so on and so forth. Like, I don't think that, you know, you don't have to be open to be good, and being closed isn't bad. It's not really like an all or nothing moral argument. But I think when you look at the big picture, you sort of like, I have a tendency in terms of the way I think things want to go. And so if you look at like the on the closed end, I think, you know, sort of Facebook is Facebook as a consumer tool is out on one side. And I'd say, you know, some of the other kind of monolithic proprietary website publishing and analytics and marketing, like there's these tools out there that are just like, you know, go come into our world, big company, and don't try to like do the internet yourself, just do our thing. They're like on the sort of more closed end of the spectrum. And Instant Pages is kind of like on the I'd say it's a little bit more threatening than Google AMP, just because it's like it wants to consume all of your content, bring it into Facebook, and essentially prevent it from being accessed in other ways, or that's the only way that you could get access to that stuff.
It reminds me of AOL a lot.
Yeah, totally.
I'm not at all familiar with that. Can somebody explain that? I don't know about Facebook Instant Pages.
All right, So Facebook Instant Pages is basically it's correct me if I'm wrong, Josh. I'm working with AMP, but not with Facebook Instant Pages. Mm-hmm. But my understanding is it's basically a subset of HTML that you can publish. And at that point, when it loads up in Facebook, when you click the link within your Facebook app, it will load the article within the Facebook app really, really quickly. Am I describing that correctly?
Yeah, basically that's correct. And sort of like Facebook Instant Pages and Apple News, although Apple News isn't getting as much traction. I mean, that's not necessarily their strong suit, but you can see how they might want to do it. I mean, a lot of this is really being driven by the fact that the normal, like, I think the other thing about the open web to acknowledge is, like, the open web has serious problems, right? And it's not, the serious problems are not that there are proprietary competitors. The serious problems are that the open web is like, not great in a number of ways. And a lot of these things now that are coming up, they are reactions to problems with delivering content to mobile devices. Like, more and more web browsing happens on mobile devices, and the experience is bad for a lot of people. And so...
Yeah, I was going to expand on that. The project I'm currently working on right now is working with accelerated mobile pages. And so it's definitely a reaction to slow loading mobile pages. On a popular project that I worked with before, I look at the network tab within Google Chrome, and I literally see 168 HTTP requests coming in. When I filter those by the domain, the host domain, only like 60 or 70 are from that host domain, which means there's over 100 JavaScript initiated files coming in from ad networks from around the world, you know, and people wonder why, you know, accelerated mobile pages is getting popular, because it's instant. It comes up, you know, and for those users, for any listeners that don't know what accelerated mobile pages is, it's a Google led open source project. And basically, once again, it's like a subset of HTML. It's very limited. You're not allowed to include any of your own custom JavaScript on there, although it does load JavaScript from the Google CDN. And at that point, there's specific HTML tags for various different elements. There's only, because you're limited in your HTML tags and in your JavaScript, you can't do a whole bunch of stuff. But at the same time, if you click on it on your phone, it just loads instantly. It's a very app-like experience. And that's kind of what the web is supposed to be. But at the same time, you're giving up a ton of control. You can't have any JavaScript on there except for, you know, what the project says you have to have.
Yeah, it's surrendering the control and the tracking, and ultimately, like, this also comes back to the economy around the web. It's ultimately the really difficult thing is it's surrendering the monetization, right? So you're surrendering your ability to generate revenue from the content in a very real way, because Google's saying, well, if you can't make it fast, it's never going to work anyway. So, like, just give it all to us and we'll make it fast, and then you'll figure something out. And Google Instant Pages is basically the same sorts of thing within Facebook's world. So Google Accelerated Mobile Pages comes up when you search. Facebook stuff comes up when people share things or you publish into Facebook. Like, I think that Facebook wants very much for publishers to just publish into Facebook, and just like Apple News wants publishers to publish into Apple News rather than, you know, perhaps it right now in addition to, but ultimately I think in like their wildest, most successful dreams, it would be instead of publishing on the web. And that's what makes it kind of like a little bit, you know, a little bit more, you can see that it's a little bit creepy. Now, I don't think though, actually, that these represent truly existential threats. I actually think that there is this kind of natural and perhaps healthy cyclical competition between proprietary or walled systems and like the more open, free systems. Like they definitely, you know, I think what this does is it makes everyone really take mobile performance of their web content seriously for a change. And then, you know, in a year or two, we'll see like, yeah, maybe you still like, I can see news organizations continuing to like try to push Google AMP and other people doing stuff like that. But it would be it'd be like having an RSS feed for your blog, right? You do that because it allows you to get your content syndicated around and placed in more places, but it's not like a replacement for your own publishing outpost.
Yeah, and it's kind of AMP's kind of an interesting case because it like a lot of people have compared it to kind of a fancy RSS feed, you know. But for me, it's like it is replacing the publishing. You're not going into the RSS feed. You're not clicking that link and going there, you know. But at the same time, it's you know, it just loads fast and it works really well. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, like, and then like there's like my like, you know, principled I want the open web to prevail and get better hat, and then there's like my actual behavior as a consumer of content, and I click the mobile AMP link all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and it's a very rewarding experience, and it's because they got it down to like it's in under a tenth of a second you get the content, and that's just like that's, you know, there's like kind of these thresholds. If you can deliver it at that speed, it feels real time. If a really good mobile website can deliver a content, if people are serious about optimizing it, in like a second or less, and that's acceptable. Like, that's totally cool. I have no problem waiting 1 second to kind of see my content. But frequently you're talking like 10, 20, you know, more. And that's just, you know, that's just not a positive experience as a user. And so I think that's where the gauntlet gets thrown down. It's like, hey, the open web needs to compete with that type of experience.
And maybe you could just mention a little bit. I listened to your talk that you gave at DrupalCon New Orleans, where you talked about that performance.
Yeah.
And you had some statistics about people waiting for 10 seconds. That was a stressful experience.
Yes, that's now, grain of salt, the research on this was sponsored by Sony Ericsson, which is a mobile technology provider, so it wasn't like done by totally blind academics. But I think, you know, it rings true, like just in your own lived experience, like the experience of waiting for mobile content to load or waiting for something to buffer actually causes elevated heart rates that are similar to what you would see when people watch horror films. And in particular, the takeaway again for people for a business person is that level of stress is much higher than the level of stress that a customer experiences like waiting in line in a brick and mortar store. So again, you're putting people through an experience that makes them unlikely to enjoy, you know, your product, and that just makes them unlikely to come back for more.
Mm-hmm. And you have the whole context switching, you know, too. If people are waiting to do something, they might open up Twitter, you know, or
that's sort of the three thresholds are the tenth of a second or 100 milliseconds is what you need to hit if you want things to feel real time. Like, that's how fast an application needs to respond. And that's a really, I mean, if you can hit that goal, you're just crushing it in terms of a user experience. 1 second is you do not interrupt the train of thought, which is like, you know, and then these are like rough things. Like one second, people are aware that there's a pause. It doesn't feel real time, but their brain will not go off and like start thinking of other things. And then at 10 seconds, you're at a really high risk of people actually starting another task because they've grown tired of waiting. And once they start another task, like, will they return? Maybe, hopefully, but you don't know.
So I tell you what, like, I feel like we're getting like more off topic toward like front end performance here. Let's kind of bring it back around. So I have a question for you. So the web, when it got popular, at least in my experience, was like filled up with AOL. There was CompuServe, Prodigy, and stuff like that, which seems very walled garden-y to me.
Yep.
Why is that such a bad thing? You know, what could, to me, like, it's, and I'm kind of playing a devil's advocate here. You have consistent usability, you have a consistent experience, it's easier for my mom to use, and why is that such a bad thing?
So I don't think, like I was saying before, it's not a bad thing a priori, right? It's not inherently wrong to have walled gardens or to have private platforms or proprietary systems. I think it's more a question of what is the overarching or total system that those things exist within. And so, like, AOL and CompuServe and Prodigy all started as their own networks. And then what they did was they would add an internet gateway. And so it was kind of like you are in AOL, but you can you have this little portal out onto the internet. And the difference for the internet was it was literally an open and free place where there was no where people were free to to create and to publish on their own. And so like the upsides are like amazing amounts of innovation happens there. Like you have the sum total of human knowledge being expressed on the web is vastly more than what AOL's editorial and management processes could ever deliver. But the downside is that like the web is like full of like crime and piracy and viruses and then also just like inconsistent experiences, and some things are, you know, bewildering or just kind of broken. And so the tension is between on the closed or managed side, kind of providing safety and a consistency of experience and a sort of the pleasantness of the experience and the kind of like some of the user value. On the flip side, it's, you know, closed systems just are, even if they are managed with the best of intentions, are inevitably never as friendly to innovation and creativity as the more open web is. And so I think that when we think about like what I think is the positive vision for the future is these closed platforms and walled gardens can totally exist, but they exist within a broader open framework. And the concern is that if, you know, everybody publishes into Facebook and everybody just lets Google do their accelerated mobile pages, and, you know, the commercial news sources of the world just start pushing all their content to Apple News because then they can charge you 99 cents for a subscription really easily. And or you have other things that are coming up like Medium, which is just saying, hey, small publishers, don't try to do your own website. Just put it all on Medium. We'll make sure it's always pretty, and we'll figure out the business end for you. That becomes like, I don't know, that starts to feel risky, because you don't have you're sort of taking away the forum whereby individual entrepreneurs or small organizations or even big organizations that want to like chart their own course and actually do innovation have a forum for doing that. Like if a mostly open web becomes a mostly closed series of platforms, just like Things will stop getting better, because the closed platforms will always drive towards people looking to monetize in ways that they can control.
And the closed platforms will also be competing against each other for traffic.
Yeah.
So they then have to innovate or die.
Well, but the thing is that if you have like five innovators competing against another, like this is the economics has shown this over and over again. Once you get like the number of innovators down to like that you can count on your fingers, the rate of innovation plummets. And you see that like right now, that's a huge concern in like the pharmaceutical industry, right? So pharma companies are consolidating, and as a result, research budgets are going down. Total money spent on research in the pharmaceutical industry is way down over the past 20 years, and it's because there are fewer companies.
I mean, that's pretty interesting. So what can we do to save the open web, and like how does Drupal fit into that? Like I'm hearing, you know the benefits of the walled gardens are security, speed, and consistency. How can Drupal provide that? How can Drupal fix that? Or can
I have a general perspective and like a somewhat self-interested perspective, which is that I think that the Drupal project has to take these kinds of challenges seriously. I think that we are Drupal 8 is I the more time I spend with it, you know, there's like definitely rough edges and things to be figured out, but the more positive I am about what you know what Drupal 8 makes possible in terms of developing much more having a much more effective process for developing user interfaces than existed in any previous version of Drupal. Like that's just kind of like a fundamental thing that it's going to pay off for years and years to come. And like the notion of like building in the awareness of mobile devices and so forth, and the ability to like, you know, have like a coherent staging and deployment process. Like those are kind of like fundamental capabilities that are going to make it much more possible for developers to address these questions. Like I think, so often historically in the Drupal project, we've been kind of focused in kind of the middle to lower end of the stack, right? Where it's mm-hmm. kind of like figuring out your entity relationships and the database schema and which, you know, how, what chain of alter hooks are being done so that you can finally like get the result that you want. And then there's always going to be like, that's always going to be some of it. But the fact that more and more like those are settled patterns and there's kind of like a right way to do that. And there are better and better, there's better and better architecture in place for actually focusing on the, not just necessarily even the front end design, but also the user experience for an administrator and a content editor. I think that like Drupal has to like, Drupal core out of the box is in a tough position because it's such a generally useful tool. It kind of still is many things to many people, if not all things to all people. And so like out of the box, it's not easy for Drupal to have like a turnkey, like smooth product experience. But I think that, what makes Drupal unique as a CMS project is the kind of the sheer quantity and human, like the number of professional or professional grade, if not professional developers who know how to build things with Drupal, the number of people hours and like brain cycles that can be brought to bear on problems is really large. Like it's actually kind of impressive how big the Drupal developer ecosystem is. And the fact that with Drupal 8 as the new platform, we will be able to shift more of that developer power towards the kinds of things that are luring people away from the open web towards the proprietary platforms. I think that's exciting to me that we can start working on those problems in the Drupal project and because problems that are further down the stack are more and more just solved problems.
We're talking with Josh Koenig, co-founder and head of product at Pantheon. We're talking about the open web and Drupal 8's place in the open web. More on that coming up right after this.
Can you hear me okay?
I hear you great.
I changed mics to the official mic.
The official mic trademark?
Yeah, TM.
Hey, it's Amber Matz, production manager and trainer from Drupalize Me. What's going on, Amber?
Hello!
I saw you in New Orleans. You gave the coolest session.
Oh, thanks. I'm still having anxiety dreams about it.
Oh, that's too bad.
I had a dream last night where I was like running to the presentation and I was late and I had disassembled all of my demos and so I wasn't ready. And it's like 2 weeks later, I'm still.
It was so not the normal DrupalCon presentation. You had hardware. You had fun stuff. It was cool.
Yeah. And everything worked for the most part. So I did live demos with the internet. And eight of them.
Ooh. And only professional trainers, trademark, can actually do that kind of thing.
I think a lot of people could do it, but yeah, I kind of gave myself a pass on the breaking the rules there. So yeah, it worked out though.
Awesome. So what's going on at Drupalize Me these days? A couple of weeks ago, the Drupal 8 Migrate series was released.
That's part one. And so Migrate has really been in heavy development. And with 8.1 being released, a lot of good features got in, especially with Contrib as well. And so we finally have some useful tools here. There's still more coming, but that's what we were really waiting for, was that 8.1 release so that we could have a meaningful chunk of tutorials for people. And so we're working on phase two, and phase two is going to be a lot more hands-on. And then we're also, you know, even though we have this very, I would say, very impressive theming guide for Drupal 8, we're still adding to that. So I'm adding more theming related tutorials. Blake Hall is adding more JavaScript goodness, so using server-side settings, Drupal settings, using Drupal T for translatable strings in JavaScript, string manipulation in JavaScript, Drupal behaviors, things like that. So we're continuing to add to our theming curriculum. And also, the other thing that I'm working on is we have this wonderful partnership with KMP University and Ryan Weaver, who the Drupal community will hopefully recognize as from Drupal cons and other events. He is a Symfony documentation lead and he does these great trainings, and he produces a lot of great trainings under the umbrella of KNP University. And we have the privilege of hosting some of those tutorial series on Drupalize Me. And so we're upgrading our Symfony series with Symfony 3. So Symfony 3 is kind of on the long-term docket, as I understand, to be eventually integrated into Drupal 8. So people struggling to learn about some of these Symfony components that are included in Drupal 8 that are really integral to module development might really find some benefit from building a Symfony app and really understanding, getting under the hood there and understanding how these components work. So we've got three series from them that are coming soon.
Wow. That's great, Amber. Thanks.
Have a great rest of the podcast. Happy podcasting.
Welcome back. So we're talking to Josh Koenig from Pantheon. We're talking about the open web and the closed web and what that means for the future of the web. And yeah, it's exciting stuff. But before we go into that, so Josh, you started out the Drupal Dojo, right?
Yeah, that was one of my earliest. That's probably still my most successful contribution to the Drupal community, I think.
So explain what the Drupal Dojo is for those that do not know.
I love the Drupal Dojo. I know Drupal because of the Drupal Dojo.
Well, thanks. That's really, really honor. It's a very great honor to hear. So the Drupal Dojo is just a learning community for people to teach other people how to Drupal. That's really what it was, and it came from a place where I had started Chapter 3 with Matt and Zach, and it was really early on. Drupal 5 had just come out, and we were doing our first real client projects, and you know, those led. I was leaning a lot on my community connections when I was running into issues and trying to figure out how to make the project successful. And I had this strong feeling that my karma balance was going into deficit, and I thought, I've contributed code and I've written some modules and I've written some patches, but I feel like I just didn't feel like I could square the scales by contributing code. So I thought what I would actually do is just mentor some people, because the idea of mentorship was starting to percolate in the community. And originally I thought it would just be getting five or fewer people who wanted to build up their Drupal skills, and like by a meeting once a week on Sundays, because I could commit that time, we would train up some people, and then they could train the next people, and that would all work out. And it turned out that there was just way far more interest in that than I had anticipated. And a lot of the people who got involved early really jumped in and expanded the concept. Like originally I thought, we'll chat in IRC and I'll help give you basically office hours for, me to give you advice on your projects. And some people were like, in an era before WebEx was even really a well-established thing, people had set up like using some arcane Java stack, like a sort of a lightweight screen sharing system, and like a control panel that put that and the IRC channel in one web page, and just kind of going through every Sunday and being like, hey, I'm going to show you how like I use all the hooks in the node system to make this web page do what it's supposed to do. And then other people started jumping in and giving training, and it, it kind of got a lot of momentum under itself. And it was really, really, I really feel honored whenever I talk to someone and they were like, oh yeah, that's how I got started. Cause it's like real practical hands on how to do stuff, and like something that we really, it was a very open web initiative. We just kind of took these existing pieces of technology and stuck them together and built like a functional remote learning system in like a couple of weeks before any of that technology really existed as a turnkey product.
I forgot how hard that was. I mean, I distinctly remember the Saturdays or Sundays, if you said it was, I was guessing it was a weekend, sitting there learning about something. And I forgot how tough it was to actually see a screen share. I mean, we're talking several years ago at this point. Right now we're on a Google Hangout. We can look at each other. We can see each other. If you wanted to see my screen, I could easily show you my screen. We could put puppy dog masks over our faces. Like how far the world has changed since then. And how far Drupal has changed as well. There's the transition, and Drupal has changed as well. So Drupal 8, lots of big things, lots of big changes, and it really positions itself well in the open web.
Yeah, I think so. And that was, I mean, again, part of my the blog post that I did and the talk that I gave is really about recognizing that the open web is the open web is a much bigger thing than Drupal, and that's good. We're a part of something bigger than ourselves, and we have a role to play, which is really again, it's like owning the fact that we're kind of the higher end tool on the open web and being really proud of that. And I think there's some angst about that, and I think we should just own it and like go for it and do it all the way.
Yeah. So what are the main problems with the open web? You know, I've heard like security, speed. What else does the open web failing at? And what do we need to do as, I don't know, web citizens or whatever you call us, to get that fixed?
So I think that you just could run down the list of problems. It's a huge list of problems. Here's one way to conceptualize the problem at a really high level. Mm-hmm. So, and again, because I'm an entrepreneur, I think about things in business terms, but I think this is actually it was a revelation when I realized this. So if you look at companies that are built on top of the open web, that are really, you know, they're providing open web services. There are a whole lot of them, obviously, like all the Drupal shops and all the people who do WordPress for a living and all this other stuff. There's a lot of chaos there. There's not a lot of consolidation, which is partly a feature, right? But do you know what company is actually, if you count it up by market capitalization and revenue, the market leader for open web stuff?
Who?
It's GoDaddy.
Okay.
I can see that.
Yeah, because they have built their whole business on providing all these, you know, all these services and all these tools that are mostly like just existing open source things or existing open protocol things. But if you think about the aesthetic of GoDaddy and the experience of going through their shopping cart funnel, I think that largely captures the problems of the open web as well, because it's just there are so many poorly disclosed choices. There's a whole lot of things that you need to worry about that are unclear. It's confusing. It's chaotic.
Patterns, I think, is what the term is. Like I would not trust my mom to go through to purchase something from GoDaddy, because they would trick her into purchasing way more than she would need.
We've been talking for 30 minutes. Can I get you a glass of water for $5?
Yeah, and I know some people that work at GoDaddy, and they're good people. It's not like that company is evil, but the aesthetic they've ruthlessly optimized that purchase process just to generate these kind of upsell opportunities. And then they have commercials where it's like, you can have a human for $1, and that's like, I'm like, oh man, what kind of person is available for $1? Is that really? Aren't we fighting to raise the minimum wage here? Isn't that something we need to do? And I don't know. And I think that ties in with what you were saying before, where, you know, another thing is the bloat, right? Where, you know, we've got ad trackers on top of ad trackers on top of, you know, a popovers and all this other stuff, where the, you know, in the media and publishing space, it's just kind of gotten out of control in terms of the glut of things that are there. And then you have all the other kind of more fundamental problems about like security, performance and scalability and things like that. And I think that, you know, the challenges of the open web are, the web is going to continue to expand, right? There are probably in the next 10 years going to be 3 or 4 more billion people using the internet than there are today. Mm-hmm. And under the current status quo of the difficulty and risk of going with an open web type solution, you can start to, like, there's it's I'm not sure whether that will win out. I think things have to improve in order for the web to continue to grow and for it not to kind of, you know, for not to kind of come apart, if it will. The downside of small pieces loosely joined is that sometimes it's a little bit kludgy. And I think if we don't work on aligning some things a little bit better, settling into some more best practices. I mean, and this goes from the bottom up. So like we just got HTTP 2, right? HTTP is about as low level as it gets for the web, like the basic protocol that we use to talk to each other. And we just got our first major revision to that. And that's, you know, that's going to pay some dividends for everybody, you know, down the line. But I think we have to think as netizens and so forth, we should be thinking about how we can kind of try to improve and build more elegant solutions and make it so that the next generation of people we train can be trained on, you know, the focused on a smaller set of higher value problems that they need to solve. And that way, you know, the number of, you know, the big advantage that we have in Drupal and for the open web in general is that there's a lot of people, individuals and organizations that can apply their knowledge and human capabilities to solving these problems and eliminating the problems and making people successful on the open web. And I think if we can get more and more leverage out of our people and we can train more and more people more easily, then we'll be fine. Right, it's more like if it continues to be really hard and no one can hire a good developer because they're just never available when you need them, and people to then try to go ahead without the right expertise and they kind of stumble, and then they're going to say, I can't do it. You know, this open web, yeah, I like the idea, but it's a pipe dream. It just can't work for me. So I'm just going to go stick all my stuff on Medium, or I'm going to have a really dumb web page, but I'll put all my content into Facebook or something like that. And I feel like that's kind of the challenge before us, is to get our stuff straightened out a little bit more so that it can scale a bit better.
Yeah, and I tell you what, when you said it needs to come from the bottom up, you know, I almost think it needs to come from all over the place. Like, you know, talking about like all those ad networks, you know, I would say like between DoubleClick and whatever else, Google, you know, owns or represents a lot of those. And I think of Google, and Google is like, you know, we talked about them being a walled garden, but as you're talking, I'm thinking they're making money off of the open web. Like, they are basically the index of the open web. And if the open web fails, if everybody moves to, you know, Google, Facebook, Apple, or something else, their search platform, which is the core business, you know, is not going to be nearly as useful.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really good point. And so like there's another argument to be made that like Google is the biggest company on the open web, and I would say that they far more so than I think Google has an existential stake in the open web continuing to thrive and exist, because it is like their core business was, hey, this open web thing makes it possible for everybody to publish all the information they want, and the amount of knowledge that's now out there in the open is. It's like truly like just take a step back. That's a revolution for humanity. Like, as you said at the beginning, this is something that is like a worldwide, it's a wonder of the world, right? But prior to Google, if anybody can remember back in those mid to late aughts, it was also really difficult to navigate that web. Because there was no, like, it was hard to find a relevant thing when you were looking for it. And what
do you remember the books that you would buy at Books a Million or Barnes and Noble? And they would have literally a book with websites in them that you could go to categorized.
Yeah, it was like a paper directory of websites.
That's what Yahoo was. Yes. In the early days of Yahoo, it was, you know, it was an
get
index.
Published in my directory. And Google, you know, they're bless them, because they took the high road, right? Not only do they have great technology, if you think about it, what did Google do right at the very beginning? They made sure that the search results came really fast. They understood that performance mattered at the very beginning. And they also understood that their objective had to be to try to optimize for the best, the most relevant result. Like, they were the only major index in the early days that wasn't doing some kind of payola behind the scenes to do rankings. And when they introduced advertising, they made it really clear what was an ad versus what was a search result. And that sort of like they were the honest broker. They had really good tech behind it too, which certainly helped. But I think the thing that made them successful ultimately was that they were the honest broker there. And now if you look at all the stuff that they've built all around that, it all depends on their ability to crawl the open web and like distill the information there into higher value things that lead people, you know, they don't try to keep you on Google's site. They just want you there for a minute because they can deliver the ad there, and that is an ad connected to an intention, which is then very high value. And that is a, that's a great business, right? That is an amazing business model, and they should be applauded for that. But they do have this, like, they have skin in the game for the open web, because you're right. If it starts to shift away and they have to fall back on what is their, like, what is their walled garden? Google Plus? That's not that's not a great platform to fall back on. They need the open web to continue to thrive.
You know, another thing that Google did that I thought was revolutionary is like the anti-GoDaddy, where like back in their, you know, the early, the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, every search engine was trying to be a portal, mm-hmm. you know, and Google said, you have a search, you have your search box and two buttons, and one of the buttons, you know, is even quicker than the other. And I thought that was really awesome. And yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's so maybe when we think about our ally, you know, where if the open web has a major ally, like I'm sure GoDaddy wants the open web to thrive, and they support a lot of great projects too, and they deserve credit for that. But I think Google is probably, you know, they definitely have an interest in seeing this fundamental aspect of the web continue to be the norm, because without that, yeah. their core revenue, like, that's still, I think, you know, close to over 80% of their revenue would be threatened.
Well, geez, like, you know, like, Google is not, it's huge now. And I really think they have conflicting interests in there, you know, like, as a front end developer, I'm constantly like reading stuff that the Chromium team is doing and about making the browser faster, best practices, you know, inline CSS, critical path, and all this really cool stuff. And at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, what would really make the web fast is if your same organization would optimize your JavaScript more and maybe, you know, make it async and not do all that stuff. That would help out. And I don't know. I just see conflicting interests from there. But at the same time, like, another walled garden is the whole app system. You know, like, Apple makes money off of every single app that's sold. Yeah. You know, so Apple has a vested interest to get content out of your website and into apps. And if it can do that, Apple is making money, you know? And
yep. Well, and I think that is their plan, or that's the, you never know what Apple's thinking, right? But if I was going to try to do a Svengali and see inside their minds with Apple News, that's clearly where that wants to go, right? Get all the content flowing through the Apple News app, and then just like with iTunes, we can start to build subscriptions around that, and then news publishers will get their revenue back, but of course Apple will take its tax. I doubt that will work, just because historically Apple's not so great at doing internet kind of software stuff. Like, that has not been their strong suit historically, and it's a much harder it's not like the recording industry where they were like facing like a much more stark existential crisis of just file sharing leading to the doom of their business if they didn't get on board with iTunes. If publishers don't have the same, it's a different dynamic. But that is clearly what they want things. The app thing is interesting to me too, because there was so many predictions in, you know, around, I'd say, maybe peaked around 2012, that like apps were just going to replace the web. The web is dead because it's all going into apps. And people were looking at look at all this time that gets spent in the apps. And like in the Facebook app and the Twitter app. And then like the subsequent research came out that like a lot of that time was actually in the embedded browser in the app. And I just think that the notion that, you know, people are going to, like, you don't see this so much anymore, but I used to chuckle in my head every time I would click a link on my phone, and like it would be, "Hey, do you want to install the app for this newspaper? Because we'd like you to, and we would be happy to show you this content if you downloaded it." And I'm like, "No, I just want to look at it on the web. Just put it on the web and let me see it." So I think that there's definitely a, you know, it's in Apple's interest to try to get more content flowing through apps, but there's. Again, it's about the diversity and the number of voices that are out there. If it gets consolidated down to four or five platforms that own all the content, then yeah, you'll have those four or five apps on your phone. But that's a pretty dark future, in my opinion. I like the future better, where people can publish on their own, in the open, and they don't have to go through some kind of other, because it just turns into a world of gatekeepers and kind of, you know, there's a place for all that, but it's within a defined subsystem that should not be the dominant milieu.
What can Drupal do to assure a bright future?
I think that, you know, again, kind of trying to articulate what I was saying before more succinctly, I think that Drupal's problems and Drupal's opportunities are moving up the stack. So I think it's Drupal can contribute by showing the world what can be done with the open web, and that means delivering better and better user experiences, higher quality, faster, more reliable, and also showing how I think one of the things that Drupal is really good at is being a kind of a hub for the open web and being a point at which a lot of data can be integrated or services can be integrated. And I think that's something where, you know, oftentimes people think if they need something like that, they have to go to a proprietary platform or a walled garden. And you can show that, no, you can do it yourself. You can own the experience. You can integrate the data. You can control your destiny. In a real way, and it's not impossible. Like, it doesn't require you to have a, you know, $100 million budget to do that. You can totally do it. And if we show that that's possible, and we show that this software makes it feasible for not everyone per se. Like, maybe not individual end consumers, but if we show that it makes it possible for, you know, people who, you know, have access to professional staff or can hire someone for a month or two, can actually get that kind of value with Drupal, I think that will be, you know, that's a sort of a strong foundation for the continuation of the open web.
Yeah. And Drupal 8 is strong in that respect, right? With, you know, a taste of web services and a better publishing experience, that kind of thing.
It really is. And the new caching system, you know, I think the new caching system is going to be huge, especially obviously for like authenticated user experiences. You know, I'm super excited about that. Yeah. 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 Big pipe and cache tags and cache contacts, all that good stuff that Wimlayers does.
Yeah.
Something else that you mentioned that, you know, I thought about with Drupal 8 is you said that, like, it frees the developers to concentrate on, you know, more higher up problems, you know, when you were talking about configuration management. And man, the time that I spend working and fighting with features, to use that time with tackling other things would be really valuable. So I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, and that's sort of like, you know, for myself and like where, like our, and again, this is totally self-interested, but I don't think it's incorrect. Like what we're trying to do at Pantheon is kind of the same sort of thing where it's like, look, historically, you would have to spend all this time and energy just to put together like internet plumbing to make this stuff possible, and just to like get a sane workflow for doing development with a team of people. And we want to basically eliminate that as a barrier to entry. And so then it becomes easier for more people to work in that way, the way that we want to as professional developers. And for the people who are already on board with that way of working, they can take all that time that would have been invested in building and maintaining that plumbing and focus it on the actual project that they're trying to do. And I think we just get more leverage out of our human efforts, right? There's like stuff that we can have done by robots should be done by robots, so that the things that only people can do, we focus the people energy and attention on.
As a web developer, we're concatenating a string. What problems do we really want to solve?
So how does how can government policies affect the openness and closeness of the web, and like what should we be listening for in regards to that?
So I think, I mean, this was an interesting, it's an interesting idea in Dries's sort of call to arms, which was the idea of a FDA for algorithms. I think there's this whole other train of thought. I've been reading a lot of writing by Zeynep Tufekci. She's a professor in North Carolina studying social media, and she writes a bunch for the New York Times. Her stuff is awesome. It talks about, it's like there's this recent controversy around the Facebook trending topic box. which was sort of this thing where it came out that it was actually not being driven just by algorithms, and there was some like human editorial oversight, and maybe because it was done by young people in Northern California, it leaned to the left, and they had to invite all these conservative people to come down to Facebook and give them the grand tour and say, no, we take our neutral stance really seriously. And it, like, to me, that was this whole controversy that was just like missing the bigger point, which is like, this is just like a thing for a little tiny box on the Facebook screen that I don't think people really, it doesn't drive that much many clicks or that many eyeballs.
I never knew that Facebook had a trending. I seriously did not know that existed until I saw the drama for that.
I actually read it all the time.
You do?
I'm the weird one. Yeah. And it's just, and it's not intended to be somebody's only source of information. Like, I hope that's not the case. Right?
No, I think it's somewhat like the Twitter trending topics. I think the intention of it, I've never clicked on it, but I have looked at it. And the intent was always like, you know, like, what's hot? What's it's like the New York Times. Like my wife is a religious reader of the New York Times online, and the first thing she goes to is actually the most emailed section. Because that kind of tells you what's buzzing on the New York Times website, the things that get emailed out the most. And I always thought it was kind of similar, like what's buzzing on Facebook right now.
That's interesting.
Which is kind of interesting to know. But the thing is that the bigger picture is, you know, what's the algorithm behind the feed? Like the main feed, the thing that everybody looks at that drives all the traffic, that all the monetization is built around. And of course they can't tell you because that's a proprietary trade secret. But there's this notion, I think it's a dangerous notion that that exists, that people just assume that if something's an algorithm, that it's somehow, you know, correct or neutral or you know, in a, like, there's all this stuff where people just sort of inherently will trust a machine, but the algorithm is just an expression of, you know, at best the biases of the engineers who put it together, and at worst it expresses like biases that are unclear even to the creators themselves. So I think that there's this we have to be really conscious of how algorithms are shaping our experiences. And it's not just, I mean, it's inevitable that this will happen more and more because it's undeniably can be very efficient and provide value, but I think we have to think about it really, really carefully. And I don't know whether an FDA for algorithms is really a good idea or not, because I don't, like, functionally, I don't trust that, like, a federal bureaucracy would necessarily work there, because I think, you know, one of the upside of the FDA is that we don't have poisoned food, and like you know, usually when your doctor prescribes something for you, it's not going to kill you. But the downside is that like the barrier to entry to create a new medicine or a new food product is super, super high, and maybe as it should be, because lives are at stake. I think if you want to just set up a new website with a new algorithm, I don't know, I don't know that like having a bureaucracy around that is really a great idea.
Well, there's different ways to do it. Like,
go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but you know, currently with drugs, you have to get approval before you can mass market them. But if the U.S. was, you know, to go down this road, it could just be you launch it and then they kind of randomly audit popular ones or something like that. I'm just kind of thinking out loud here.
Well, the barrier to entry to nutritional supplements, right? So it's not really an algorithm. It's just. There's got to be a way around it, right? And that's what happens when you put any sort of bureaucracy in front of somebody. Is
right.
Well, but I think things.
there's a really interesting question about this in terms of. So I think that like in a perfect world, I think that the spirit of the open web is such that we want competition and like a sort of general drive towards transparency and disclosure to kind of solve these problems. And the reality is that like that doesn't just happen naturally, automatically, right? And so actually I think, you know, if we're going to talk about how the government would be involved, it'd be more interesting to me to think about, and again, I have no idea how workable or how one would actually make this work. It'd be more interesting to think about how just simply enforcing antitrust might be a way. Like, is it right that Google can, you know, does all the search engine ads, but also all the sort of like placement ads and banner ads and so forth? Like, maybe that's, you know, historically we broke up big railroad companies, broke up big oil companies, broke up big telecom companies. And I think that there's downsides to that kind of that. That's like very heavy-handed. But the upside is that it reopens a market for it reopens the field for competition, right? There's a you know, they're like, what's the incentive for Google to really optimize the whole Dart system? They don't have strong competitors there. There's not an alternative ad marketplace that of similar traction that offers publishers everything that they need from that they're getting from Google now, but offers users a better experience. And that's just because of the huge incumbency power that Google's rolled up over the past decade. And so I think sort of examining things for health it becomes difficult to see how you maintain the subjectivity of that examination itself. I mean, although maybe it's possible, I'm kind of more drawn to solutions that are like making sure that the market doesn't get overly consolidated and that there is, that we basically try to ensure that there's meaningful competition and meaningful decentralization of the powers so that, people can still innovate and we're not stuck like waiting for one or two companies to deliver everything for us.
Yeah, and that's something a little bit like easier to grasp, for people than like auditing, an algorithm or something like that too, Although like the political will to break up a large company like Google that, contributes millions of dollars to various different politicians is.
Yeah, it's not so well. If it was politics, I'd say like we should break up big pharmaceutical companies first because there's like a lot more. There's a huge amount. There's a lot more threat and a lot more value there. Like big pharmaceutical companies, big agricultural companies, big oil companies, big banks. Those are things that probably where the bigness impacts daily life more, but they're even more entrenched. So yeah, I don't know whether that happens. Although, one thing that you just said that made me think of was without necessarily relying on government to do this kind of ad hoc auditing, it would be really interesting to see kind of like investigative journalism of algorithms and how they work. Like if people I could see like it'd be really interesting to have a nonprofit foundation that subsidized that kind of research.
When the source is closed though, why would anybody be able to learn what the answer was? Like,
go ahead.
Yeah, you just put different queries in it and see what happens, And if you put enough in there, you're going to figure out how it's filtering and what seems to rise to the top. You can still gather a lot of information, that's what people would do with search engine optimization. You have all these companies like Moz and stuff that basically just, they try to work with the same data sets that Google has by indexing the web, and they look at Google search results and then they figure out this is how Google does it.
Yep, the reverse engineering. Point,
yeah. Yeah. So you just reverse engineer it. So I mean that's a lot more difficult to do with Facebook than it is with Google, because Google is on the Facebook is very much so walled garden. But anyway, yeah, I think we're
even having the government enforce something like that is always been fascinating to me because it's the internet. It's beyond borders,
right?
Yeah, maybe something like investigative journalism or something like that. That Josh just said, like have some type of nonprofit, maybe like the EFF or something like that. If they had enough money to do that type of stuff, and if you could expose these companies for doing that, if they do them, no one really knows if they do. At that point, I think that would be, deterrence for them to do things like that. I mean, Facebook is, I think right now, like Facebook is probably like, scared shitless of like all the conservatives in Washington that kind of don't understand Facebook. And they're thinking that Facebook is trying to affect this, upcoming election. And so that's why they're there. They're giving them these tours and stuff like that. If you can find proof of meddling with these algorithms and stuff like that, or biases, I mean, that would go a long way, in my opinion.
But Facebook can have a bias.
What's
absolutely
that?
Absolutely, it's not to say that you can't have the bias. I think it's the pernicious thing is when the bias is undisclosed and kind of unknown. So it's sort of like it's okay to have, right? So like to use the FDA metaphor, right? It's totally legit to have food that's terrible for you, but the fact that it's terrible for you is made clear and quantified, in fact, in the nutritional information box that everyone's required to place there. And likewise, I think it's fine to have algorithms that are, you know, the biggest critique of Facebook's algorithm, to the extent that people have looked at reverse engineering it, is not that it has any kind of ideological bias, but that it has a bias towards engagement at all costs, because that's what they monetize, and then that has a way of surfacing things that are dramatic, that create that create a certain amount of controversy, or that kind of get people into going on a spree of clicking like on stuff. So the critique is that their algorithm optimizes either for totally frivolous things like the Upworthy is like the first people to figure out that you could actually make a website that could get traction that way, but it's like, you know, stuff that's like relatively frivolous, mostly like cat pictures. And on the other side, it provides this like weird traction.
You just didn't call cat pictures frivolous, did you?
I'm sorry, let me take a step back.
The internet.
I'm just gonna say. Pictures, right? Anyway, keep on going.
Right, so it's like things like that, or on the flip side, like it also provides a way for these kind of like not good things to gain traction. Like you think Facebook has actually been a really great way for people who are opposed to vaccinating their children to like spread misinformation and lies, right? Mm-hmm. And that's like that's a inherent risk with the open web, because anybody who wants to can publish. But I think in the open web context, it's actually harder to see how misinformation and lies and things like that, you know, there's a larger chance that they become kind of exposed. Whereas inside of these sort of siloed systems, like if an idea has that kind of, or at least within Facebook's algorithm, right, if that idea has that kind of like in attraction for people, it helps promote like things that aren't great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, Josh.
Yeah, so where can we find out more about this type of stuff? Like you've shared a couple of links with us before. We'll throw them below our podcast on the web, on our open web. Is there any other information about this that we should be, that our listeners can go to look up if they're interested?
Yeah. So, there's the blogs we've written in. I'm working on writing and publishing more stuff on this. So, if you follow my Twitter handle, whether I publish it on my personal blog or my work blog, or I find a way to get it published somewhere else.
What's your AOL keyword?
That's right. It is Josh _outlandish_2426. You can find me in the directory. The only other one the only other thing that I would mention is we talked about this at the very beginning. For people who are newer, for people who started building the internet sometime after the year like 2005, 2006, if you came into building the internet kind of with Drupal and either just because it was later on in your career, or you're a younger person, there is a wonderful piece of old original internet called the Clue Train Manifesto that I recommend. I like reread this at least once a year. And it was something that was put together in 1999 by a bunch of essentially marketing professionals who really drank the internet Kool-Aid very deeply, and they put together this screed. It was a marketing guy at IBM, and Doc Searles, who was one of the first bloggers, but he has a background in marketing, and Dave Weinberger, who's an academic, an academic who studied communications, and they drank the internet Kool-Aid very deeply, and then brought forth this screed about how, look, this is changing the way that things work. We are going to, you know, it's like the people formerly known as the audience now have a voice, and you need to talk to us like people, not like press releases. And then goes through the whole thing of like, this is what the internet makes possible. This is how it works. And to me, that is like that's like the Federalist Papers of the open web, if you will.
I love it.
I just went to it.
Hamilton, Madison, and Jay are proud.
Yeah, exactly. Then they did a and a couple of them did an update last year, which was actually really interesting because they were kind of like, wow, look, social media has come around and that's interesting, but let's see, let's talk about what that really means. And there's like good things and there's horrible things, and they're just, you know, it's kind of like it's inspiring in the same way as like going back and looking at some of the stuff that that, you know, like Vint Cerf and Tim Berners-Lee, when they were really, before any of this stuff came together, they were just putting together these protocols, and they were like, you know what, this will make possible, this will be able to happen, and that will be good. And that was like, you know, the idea that we could just create an interconnected network of knowledge around the world. Like, it was just a basically theoretical capability. But if you talk about the values that they were embedding in those protocols at the beginning, it's inspiring to me, because I think that we're still fulfilling and living through those values when we, you know, as we build the internet together.
Cool. You have all right. So you're outlandish, Josh, on Twitter. Do you have any upcoming conferences or talks or anything like that that you want to talk about?
No. My conference. So I had a became a father earlier this year, which has been
congratulations.
Awesome. Thank you. But it means that my conference, I usually used to get out at least once every couple of months to a camp or a conference, and yeah. I made it to DrupalCon New Orleans, but I have no other out of town conference events on my schedule yet. But cool. I'll keep you posted on the internet as things come up.
Gotcha.
Now's your shot. What's cool happening at Pantheon these days?
So cool and happening at Pantheon. I think we're like really, really loving the way in which our agency focus has helped us like sharpen our product roadmap and sharpen the way and improve the way that we do, you know, support, improving the way that we do, just like engage on the business side with people. And we've got a bunch of cool stuff that's, you know, some of the stuff that came out a little bit earlier this year, and some more stuff that's building on that, that's going to come out in the next couple months, where I don't know if any of you saw our booth at DrupalCon, but we always do like a big demo, right? That's always been the centerpiece of our booth. And my colleague Matt Cheney, he redid the demo from top to bottom to showcase like all the new things we can do with Drupal 8, all the things that are possible with the like new tools we have for integration. Didn't make it into the demo because it's a little bit hard to demo in a big screen at a conference. We have like really great command line development on our command line tools, kind of like kind of for people who want to automate more or tie things together. Like, again, becoming more of like a way in which people set things up and tie them together. Like, I think we're going to be doing some really awesome stuff this year with integrations and so forth. So it's like, it's all based around like, you know, we've always had this pretty cool elastic hosting platform that can scale, and it's like super consistent between environments, and that's got a lot of value, and we can take any website, large or small, and run it really fast and securely. But now we're really kind of like bringing home the value for getting the website built in the first place and then making the updates after it goes live and managing it, you know, sort of like for, you know, real people who are serious about their website. They don't just want to publish content frequently, which is why they need a CMS. They want to like make the website better frequently. And I think we're actually starting to see that we can make that a really good experience for people. And I'm super stoked about that.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Josh.
Hey, thank you for having me. This was a really fun conversation. I appreciate it.
It honestly was a fun conversation. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, totally.
And thank you, Mr. Matt Cleef.
Of course. Thank you, Mike Herschel.
Yeah. All right. I will be speaking at Nice Camp. I think it's maybe second weekend of July, talking about Chrome developer tools for any listeners that are in New York City area.
Nice Camp. You mean like New York City, right?
Yep. NYC Camp.
What's nice about New York City?
The people.
Of course.
And the pizza.
Sorry, I didn't warn you. That was going to happen at some point.
That's all right.